From high above the storm clouds in the North Carolina Reading Service blimp, formerly the Triangle Radio Reading Service blimp, this is John Federson with Indie Week from February 5th of 2020. We read for our blind and print-impaired audience. And thanks to our musicians today, the duo known as the Balloon Attunes, and they'll launch again at the end of the show. There they go. Safe landings. And let's head right into our opening voices column. And this is old friend Barry Saunders, who had been a contributor for the News and Observer. And now he has a column today, and he's titled it 17 Cents. While driving down the street a month ago, I experienced a Big Mac attack. This really blew my mind, since I hadn't thought of a Big Mac in several years and hadn't had one in probably 20. My truck turned, seemingly of its own volition, into the McDonald's parking lot on Roxborough Street. I went into the restaurant and, mouth and heart filled with anticipation, ordered one. Big mistake, folks. The two all-beef patties were cold, the lettuce wilted, and the special sauce was anything but. Don't even ask about the pickles. Under normal circumstances, I'd have tossed that culinary disaster into the trash after one bite and kept on trucking, but I was hungry, so I ate the whole thing. Even so, after 20 years, I refused to let the bad burger slide. The restaurant's number was on the receipt, so I called, and in my best let-me-speak-to-the-manager voice, said, "Let me speak to the manager." I explained what happened, that after 20 years, I decided to buy a Big Mac, and the one I got was stone cold. Was the manager understanding? Did he offer my money back? Did he tell me to come down so he could prepare one just for me with some extra special sauce? Negative. Dude merely explained that, quote, "A lot has changed in 20 years, and they no longer make the burger to order when you come in." The patties, he explained, might have been sitting under a heat lamp for a considerable length of time when I ordered them. Sensing that I, like Mick Jagger, was about to get no satisfaction, I then went online and filled out what seemed like a 200-question customer service questionnaire, at the end of which I reported the manager's candid but insufficient response. That was weeks ago, and I've yet to hear a word from Ronald the Hamburglar or anyone else associated with that corporation. The unsavory McDonald's experience came to mind recently when I saw some McDonald's employees and their supporters outside the downtown Durham location banging the drums, actually red plastic buckets, anything else they could get their hands on, in support of workers' demand for a $15 hourly wage. The protest, wrote the Indy's Tomasi McDonald, my cousin, but no relation to Ronald, was part of the Raise Up NC / Fight for 15's ongoing campaign, calling on McDonald's to, quote, protect its employees' safety, address what they say is rampant sexual harassment, pay its workers $15 per hour, and recognize their right to organize a union. A 2015 study by Purdue University School of Hospitality and Tourism Management contends that if workers were paid $15 an hour, the cost of that Big Mac that now costs $3.99 would soar to, wait for it, $4.16. I don't know about you, but I'd gladly pay, wait a minute, let me do some ciphering here, an extra 17 cents for a burger if I knew that the person who prepared it could afford to feed her or his own children or had health insurance or benefits that allowed them to stay home when sick. The study also found that raising the minimum wage would save the restaurant industry billions of dollars because employee turnover and the cost of training new employees would be lower. People tend to stay longer in jobs where they feel appreciated. Sounds like a no-brainer, right? If so, some people are walking around with no brains. The number of people who were unsympathetic to the workers' cause surprised me. Of the 10 people to whom I spoke, some as they exited a McDonald's with a bag of victuals, 4 of them said either the workers didn't deserve 15 an hour, or if they did, they wouldn't be willing to pay more to ensure that they got it. If they don't like it, they can always get another job that pays more, said one minivan-driving mom. $15 an hour is a lot of money just for flipping burgers, a black leather-clad man in a red bandana said as he crossed the parking lot to his Harley. Yikes. My soul rests a little easier, though, because the majority of people were willing, nay, eager, to pay more. They felt as I do. 17 cents is a small price to pay to ensure that the person handling your food is happy, has health care, and doesn't have to come to work sick. As a certified Jeopardy addict, I recall a Final Jeopardy question decades ago, possibly further back than when I had my last Big Mac, that went something like, "This is the national minimum wage." One contestant, who probably could tell you the name of Louis XIV's wig maker's second cousin, hadn't a clue. Her response, $15. Knowing that the minimum wage at the time was under $4 an hour, I thought, man, I'd love to live in her world. I still would. And we move to the next page, the good, the bad, and the awful column today. The Greensboro Four get the good badge. 60 years ago Saturday, February the 1st, 1964, North Carolina, A&T freshmen, David Richmond, Franklin McCain, Ezell Elie Blair, and Joseph McNeil walked into a Woolworths on Elm Street in downtown Greensboro, purchased toothpaste and other products from the desegregated retail counter, and then sat down at the lunch counter and asked for coffee. As expected, they were refused. "We don't serve Negroes here," a waitress told them. But they didn't move. Not until the store closed. They went back to A&T, recruited 20 more black students, and returned the next day. They made the news. The third day, 60 people joined. The fourth, more than 300. Soon, the movement spread across the South. By July, that Woolworth store desegregated. Then most others followed. In 1964, the Civil Rights Act banned segregation in public accommodations. And their badge for bad, oh, the UNC Board of Governors. It's hard to think how the UNC system could have handled the Silent Sam debacle any worse. Not only did the system give the Sons of Confederate Veterans $2.5 million to build a shrine to that felled monument, but now we learn that the other part of that settlement, the $74,999 the system gave the group, wasn't to keep it from waving Confederate flags on UNC campuses. That was a lie. As the Daily Tar Heel reported last week, the system actually gave the SCV the money to purchase the rights to the statue from the United Daughters of the Confederacy, which had given it to UNC in 1913. That way, the SCV would have legal standing to sue UNC. Follow us here. UNC gave the SCV money so that the SCV could sue UNC so that UNC could give the SCV money. Hooray, fiscal responsibility. Oh, and about that very precise dollar amount, if it had gone $1 up to $75,000, the Board of Governors would have needed Attorney General Josh Stein's approval. And for our awful badge, we go to the Senate and our Senator Richard Burr. We've dunked on Tom Tillis for being a spineless dope throughout the impeachment process. But with the final vote coming Wednesday and Donald Trump's acquittal all but guaranteed, it's time we paid Richard Burr some attention. He is, after all, the chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee. He's been a senator for 15 years and was a congressman for a decade before that. He's not running again in 2022, so he's not beholden to the MAGA crowd. So if anyone was poised to be this generation's Sam Ervin, North Carolina senator who chaired the Watergate Committee, it's Richard Burr, except Burr doesn't give a poop. Even if there was a quid pro quo, there was. Even if the president tried to coerce a foreign government into announcing sham investigations into his rivals, he did. That doesn't, quote, rise to the level of removal, Burr declared last week. And then, to underline that he does not give a poop, Burr handed out fidget spinners during the trial. And, of course, he voted against allowing evidence or testimony, because who needs that? And now from news from North Carolina by Michael Pappage, defining hate. A fierce debate that started in Durham last year over what is and is not anti-Semitism has spread to the state's Human Relations Commission, and it could move to the General Assembly. At the state HRC's September 26th meeting in 2019, representatives from the North Carolina Coalition for Israel asked the commission to encourage the legislature to adopt the State Department's definition of anti-Semitism. Adopted in May of 2016, this definition includes several components related to the state of Israel. Claims that Israel's existence is racist, requirements that Israel do things not demanded of other democratic nations, and insinuations that Jews are collectively responsible for Israel's actions are all considered anti-Semitic. However, quote, criticism of Israel similar to that leveled against any other country cannot be regarded as anti-Semitic. But at another HRC meeting last Thursday, members of the Jewish Voices for Peace pushed back, arguing that changing the definition would shut down dissent over Israel's policies and Palestine's rights. It's flawed logic to label critics of Israel as anti-Semitic, said Trudy Bennett to commissioners. It portrays me as having a failed loyalty and Palestinians as criminals. This controversy originated last year with a Durham City Council statement that its police would not participate in international exchanges that included military-style training. That decision followed pressure from the coalition group Demilitarize Durham to Palestine, which asked the city not to allow its police to undergo counterterrorism training in Israel. While the council statement covered exchanges with any country, an opening paragraph quoted Chief C.J. Davis saying there had been no effort to initiate exchanges with Israel. That, along with an understanding of where the statement came from, sparked a firestorm. The NC Coalition for Israel sued the city when it refused to remove the mention of Israel from the statement. It was one of three lawsuits, in fact. Another argued that the council had violated the open meetings law by discussing the statement in group emails. All three have been dismissed. Most recently, the NC Coalition for Israel's in December, the group plans to appeal. In September, coalition members made it clear why they wanted the state's definition of anti-Semitism to change. We ask that you protect us, Jerome Fox, who is part of the coalition's lawsuit, told HRC. How can you do that? You can encourage the North Carolina legislature to adopt the State Department's definition of anti-Semitism. That could go a long way in preventing the Durham situation from occurring in other unsuspecting North Carolina towns. They didn't buy the argument that criticism of Israel is a separate thing. Make no mistake, said Amy Rosenthal, when these groups say Israel, they mean Jews. Durham isn't the only place where this debate has surfaced in North Carolina. In March of 2019, the U.S. Department of Education investigated a conference held by the Duke-UNC Consortium for Middle East Studies over accusations of bias and because several speakers were involved in the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement. I don't see how you can talk about the conditions in Gaza without talking about its relationship to Israel, says UNC Professor Elise Crystal, an advisor to Students for Justice in Palestine. The conference was also criticized for a performance by Palestinian rapper Tamer Nafar, who started a song by calling it his anti-Semitic song. Crystal says Nafar was being satirical, calling attention to the notion that criticism of Israel is anti-Semitism. If your song is anti-Semitic, you're not going to say that, Crystal says. The song was about being in love with a Jewish woman. The Department of Education's investigation, instigated by Republican Congressman George Holding, led to threats to cut the Middle East Studies Consortium's Title VI funding, $235,000 in total. We do not see how these activities support the development of foreign language and international expertise for the benefit of U.S. national security and economic stability, said Robert King, Assistant Secretary for Post-Secondary Education. King also alleged that the consortium was treating Islam more favorably than Christianity and Judaism. In December, President Trump signed an executive order classifying discrimination against Jews as a Title VI violation, which refers to discrimination based on race, color, or national origin. The order also expands the State Department's definition of anti-Semitism to include college campuses. What a Jew is now redefined as a national identity, as if all Jews come from Israel, Crystal says. What connects us as Jews is not national origin. In 2017, Governor Cooper signed into law a bill banning the state from doing business with companies that boycott Israel, an indication that were the HRC to push this new definition, lawmakers might adopt it. In 2017, Governor Cooper signed into law a bill banning the state from doing business with companies that boycott Israel, an indication that were the HRC to push this new definition, lawmakers might adopt it. This, Fox says, would be a victory for the Jewish community. In his view, you can't separate anti-Zionism from anti-Semitism. As he told HRC in September, although the anti-Israel cohorts who influenced the city council members have not drawn swastikas on my doors, I contend that denying the Jewish people, one of the oldest nations on the planet, a right to a sovereign state of their own in their ancestral homeland is tantamount to anti-Semitism. Globally, anti-Semitism has been on the rise, with far-right political parties taking power in Brazil, Poland, and Hungary. All three of those countries, however, maintain close ties with Israel. The Israeli government, which says it is for the protection of Jewish people, ignored the cries of Jewish people, said John Luke Kurush of Jewish Voice for Peace, told HRC last week. The HRC didn't indicate which way it was leaning, though committee member Angelo Mate asked Jewish Voices for Peace representatives last week if they had a different definition of anti-Semitism. They pointed toward the definition used by Jews for racial and economic justice, which says, in part, it has functioned to prevent the prevailing economic system and the almost exclusively Christian ruling class by must be protect the prevailing system and the ruling class by diverting blame for hardships onto Jews. The myth changes and adapts to different times and places, but fundamentally it says that Jews are to blame for society's problems. And I will just take parenthetically to apologize for glitches or repeats in certain parts of these broadcasts, because even up here in the radio service blimp, we are subject to electrical discharge, I guess, and our boards have gone blank for a couple of seconds now and again. So let's just get on to news from Raleigh. The middle is a muddle, Lee Taus's column about Marianne Baldwin's police review board. Outside the Big Lots, a man in a gold jacket stood near the trash cans. The 9/11 caller said a black handgun fell to the ground from under his shirt. He picked it up and stuck it in his jacket, then looked around and entered the store. He was an African-American, older man with a gold jacket. It looks like he's getting ready to go on Saturday Night Live and a toboggan on, the caller said. He was acting shady. Less than an hour later, he'd be dead, shot by a Raleigh police officer responding to the 9/11 call. Keith Dutree Collins, 52, lived in a nearby apartment complex and was likely walking home on Pleasant Valley Road when the officer approached him. Instead of following the officer's orders, Police Chief Cassandra Deck Brown says Collins ran. While being chased, Collins produced a gun. The officer fired multiple rounds, striking Collins multiple times. He was taken to the hospital, where he died. Collins' death is the latest in a series of high-profile use-of-force incidents that have drawn calls for police accountability, including a viral video of two officers beating Braley Andres Batista Concepcion until his face was covered in blood. For years, Raleigh activists have sought an oversight board with disciplinary and subpoena powers. Last year, the city's Human Relations Commission agreed, but the city manager refused to allow the HRC to present its recommendation to the council. Deck Brown opposes any board, believing it will interfere with her officers' ability to do their jobs. In a unanimous vote at its meeting on Tuesday, the Raleigh City Council struck a compromise that gave neither group what it wants, a largely toothless review board. We need to do something, and it's a first step and a compromise, Mayor Mary Ann Baldwin told the Indy on Monday. Sometimes when you make nobody happy, maybe that's the best solution. City staffers presented a report based on community feedback from 6 forums late last year. Only 191 people attended those meetings and 83 were police officers. The report concludes, quote, "There is a strong desire from community members that council should do something to address the issues of transparency and accountability in the form of some type or model of review board. The board will consist of 5 members, a mental health professional, civil rights attorney, representative from the LGBTQ community, a victim's advocate, and an appointee from the police department. The board would be charged with reviewing the police department's policy and, quote, building trust with the community," Baldwin says. Giving a review board subpoena or disciplinary power, she points out, would require asking the General Assembly for permission. She thinks that's a losing battle. Dec Brown did not respond to a request for comment on Monday. Diana Powell, Executive Director of Justice Served NC, says the board won't solve all the problems, but at least we're getting a start versus having nothing. City Council member Nicole Stewart, who previously opposed a review board because she didn't think it would be effective, agrees. "Does putting something on the ground help us move forward, or are we giving everybody nothing that they want?" Stewart says. "I'm hopeful that by moving forward, we're giving folks something and starting to build some trust and test some ideas to see what works and learning from what doesn't." But the activist group Raleigh Police Accountability Community Task Force, which has lobbied for years for more police oversight, isn't happy. Not with the feckless board Baldwin is proposing, and not up with the fact that it wasn't given a heads up before it was announced. Far from building trust, PACT argues, the city is taking a step backward. "This board does nothing," said coalition coordinator Serena Johnson to the Indy on Monday night. "It gives us no power to make any decisions. This is setting us back because it's an illusion of progress." And now Jeffrey C. Billman, who's the executive editor, I believe, of Indy Week, hunting for a president. This is from a column called Soapboxer. "Early voting starts next week. What should we look for in a candidate? After 15 interminable months, God knows how many debates, thousands of campaign ads, a million polls, a billion very urgent fundraising emails, frontrunners collapsing, sorry, Kamala, nobody's becoming somebody's, hey, you Pete, flashes in the pan burning out, Beto, should have been's never being, we'll always have that housing plan, Julian Castro, and billionaires making TV stations rich, after all of that, voting in the Democratic primaries finally began this week. I have no idea what's going to happen over the coming weeks, and as the Indy goes to press, I'm still not entirely clear what happened in Iowa on Monday night, but in North Carolina, early voting starts next week. So, after months of vacillation, I've got a decision to make. Ideologically, according to those myriad online quizzes, I most align with Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren. But ideology isn't my primary motivator. My decision is more rudimentary, framed by one key principle. Donald Trump and the authoritarian movement that brought him to power is a malignancy that has infected the Republican Party. The longer he remains in power, the more likely is to corrupt the entire body politic. Which brings us to the most important thing I'm looking for in a candidate, someone who can win. Right now, polling generally shows Joe Biden outperforming the rest in head-to-heads with Trump, but not by enough to matter, especially after Trump's propaganda machine makes the Ukraine conspiracy theory Hillary's emails 2-0. Besides, Biden hasn't raised a lot of money or generated much enthusiasm. He does, however, appeal to the Trump-wary suburbanites who won Democrats the House in 2018. So does Mike Bloomberg. But Biden will have problems marshaling the base. Bernie Sanders won't. If he's successful in turning out new voters, he'll fundamentally reshape the electorate. But it's a high-risk, high-reward proposition. After $1 billion of hammer and sickle ads, those suburbanites might stick with the devil they know. Elizabeth Warren, meanwhile, is trying to split the difference, reaching out to Bernie's voters while playing footsie with the party establishment, a strategy that's pleased editorial boards but hasn't seemed to pay off otherwise. As 2016 taught us, winning more votes isn't enough. You have to win the right votes in the right places. This year, that will mean Michigan, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, North Carolina, Arizona, and Florida. Which brings us to the second thing. Someone who can win the Senate. When this history of the era is written, there will be no greater villain than Mitch McConnell. As long as he's running the Senate, any Democratic president will be hamstrung, not just on ambitious things like Medicare for All or the Green New Deal, but judicial nominations and budgets. Assuming Doug Jones loses in Alabama, Democrats will need four pickups and to win control. Maine and Colorado look doable, but Senate victories in North Carolina, Arizona, and Georgia will require a strong top-of-ticket showing. These are redder states where Dems have traditionally run as pragmatic moderates. Then again, in North Carolina, millennials and Gen Zs comprise 36% of registered voters, up from 30% in 2016 and 32% 2 years ago. In 2018, when the state's Democrats narrowly outvoted Republicans, about a third of them showed up, while two-thirds of baby boomers did. If a candidate can double their turnout, you can throw out the old playbook. Number three, someone who will democratize our democracy. By 2040, 70% of the country will live in 16 states, which means 30% of the country, mostly white, rural, and conservative, will have a supermajority in the Senate. They'll also have an outsized say in the Electoral College, which means they'll have an outsized say in judicial nominations, too. Ours will be a government by a minority dictated by geography. This isn't just a future problem. The last two Republican presidents claimed the White House after receiving fewer votes than their opponents. The 53 Republican senators represent 15 million fewer Americans than the 47 Democrats. The next president needs to put this democracy gap front and center, beginning with a push for the National Popular Vote Interstate Compact and statehood for Puerto Rico and Washington, D.C. There's a lot more. There's a lot more on the next president's agenda. Of course, Trump's racist and environmentally calamitous executive orders need to be shredded. Alliances need to be rebuilt. Democratic guardrails need to be reestablished, and yes, we urgently need to address climate change and universal health care, socioeconomic inequality, and criminal justice reform. To accomplish any of that, the Senate needs to kill the filibuster. Warren and Pete Buttigieg are on board, and Sanders and Amy Klobuchar are open to it. Biden, who still labors under the delusion that he can turn the GOP sane, isn't. Even then, the next president will need the likes of Joe Manchin to get legislation through the Senate that will constrain the realm of the possible. Ultimately, big structural reforms will require big reforms to our institutional structures. First things first, though, we have to excise the cancer. Words of the Damned. Tomasi McDonald's column. In a new book, Inmates on North Carolina's Death Row, explore what life is like when you're waiting to die. Michael J. Braxton. The day I walked into death row, I felt like an alien. My mind was a haze of confusion and disbelief. I wore sadness on my shoulders and disaster behind my eyes. Condemnation thudded in my chest. With leaden steps, I walked into a warped capsule that was desolate, though filled with men, men with empty gazes and dejected postures like forgotten relics, tarnished by the cruelties of incarceration. I have never seen a walking dead man before. I was now cast amongst them. I dragged what was left of my mother's son and my state-issued property into a dim 6-by-10-foot single cell, collapsed under the folds of a mattress and cried. As sleep reached up to cradle me, I prayed that I would not wake up. In 1996, Michael Braxton was sentenced to die for killing another inmate at Caledonia Correctional Center in Halifax, where he was already serving a life sentence for killing a man during a robbery in Raleigh. According to court documents, he was running an illegal canteen and cards operation at Caledonia. A man named Dwayne Maurice Caldwell owed him $17. Though other inmates pooled their money to pay off Caldwell's debt, Braxton gave them their money back, telling them it was a principal thing. He then stabbed Caldwell 18 to 20 times in the shower. It's not the kind of story that elicits sympathy, and it contrasts with the poetry of his words, which have been compiled by Tessie Castillo as part of her own new book, Crimson Letters, Voices from Death Row. So too are the words of his fellow Death Row residents, Lyle May, Terry Robinson, and George Wilkerson, who likewise were convicted of horrific crimes. In 1999, May was given two death sentences for the stabbing and beating murders of a 24-year-old woman and her 4-year-old son. That same year, Robinson was sentenced for fatally shooting a pizza inn manager during an attempted robbery. And in 2006, Wilkerson was given two life sentences for shooting and killing an 18- and 19-year-old. Castillo started working on the book when she was an advocacy and communications coordinator with the North Carolina Harm Reduction Coalition, a nonprofit that seeks to reduce opioid overdose deaths. In that role, in 2013, she pushed the General Assembly to pass a Good Samaritan law, which allows a person experiencing or witnessing an overdose to call 911 for help without fear of criminal repercussions. She quit her job in 2018 to work on the book full-time. Its title, she says, reflects the color of the jumpsuits the inmates wear. Despite their crimes, she says, her time with them convinced her of the need to share their humanity with the world. The true genius of prison as punishment is not to lock men in cages or condemn them to die, Castillo writes in the prologue, but to starve them of love. And here's another excerpt from Paul Brown. My stepdad left when I was 9, telling me I had to be the man of the house. It was a brutal environment. People had to know they couldn't fuck with me. That's where my focus had to be. But I didn't do a good job. I was not a good big brother or man of the house. I was afraid. I was a kid. I was conflicted. My spirit is gentle, yet I had to compete and contend with killers. Released in January, Crimson Letters comes at a critical moment in the history of capital punishment in North Carolina. The state hasn't executed anyone in almost 14 years, not since Samuel Flippin was given lethal injection on August 18, 2006, and it's unlikely the machinery of death will restart anytime soon. Juries are doling out death penalty less and less. In 2019, 3 inmates were added to death row. The 2 years before that, none. It's clear that race has always been a factor in deciding who lives and dies in North Carolina. In his 2019 book, Lethal State, A History of the Death Penalty in North Carolina, UNC Chapel Hill history professor Seth Koch argues that from the beginning, lynching and the death penalty were in fact closely related, with racial subjugation as a principal goal of the criminal justice system. Right now, 143 people, 140 men and 3 women, are sentenced to die in North Carolina. More than half of them are black, though blacks account for just 13% of the state's population. Only 53 are white. That fact is at the heart of an appeal of the state Supreme Court heard in August. Attorneys for 6 condemned inmates, 5 men and 1 woman, argued that racial bias marred their trials and resulted in their death sentences. Their case stems from the Racial Justice Act, which the General Assembly passed in 2009. It required a review of potential racial discrimination in death penalty trials. 4 of those inmates, Tillman Golphin, Christina Walters, Marcus Robinson, and Quintel Augustine, were resentenced to life without parole. But after Republicans gained a supermajority in 2012, they repealed the RJA and the 4 were sent back to death row. The other 2 prisoners, Andrew Ramser and Rayford Burke, filed RJA claims before the law was repealed, but those claims weren't heard until after. And their appeals were dismissed because the RJA no longer existed. The Supreme Court hasn't yet decided whether the first 4 are entitled to life sentences or whether Ramser and Burke have the right to have their claims heard. Last February, a group of former prosecutors, judges, and law enforcement officials filed an amicus brief asking the court to go a step further and throw out the death penalty altogether. If the court rules in their favor, it could have far-reaching implications for the future of the death penalty in the state. Braxton, I'd much rather have a quick gunshot to the head or the heart than endure this type of agony. It's excessive. I committed a crime. I deserve to be punished. Well, then take me out and blow my brains out right away, but don't do me like this. 24 years of torment? I didn't torment any of my victims like this. This is the type of poop that will make a mind unravel, and that breaks you. It'll make you lose your sanity till you're falling apart. I don't want to get out of bed sometimes. It's a shame when the only relief you can hope for is death. In late 2013, Central Prison opened Death Row to community volunteers for the first time. Castillo started a journaling class that gained 24 participants. Others came in and taught yoga, art, Toastmasters, chess, and restorative justice, Castillo recalls. They even put on plays for the Vera Institute. Death Row was a lively place for a while, but that was shut down after a couple of years. A new warden came in who is real old school and about punishment. All the classes are gone now. Castillo's time as a volunteer was short-lived. 6 months into the program, she writes in Crinsman letters, she was bothered by newspaper accounts of a newly condemned man's trial and the public cries of what she described as an off-with-his-head mentality. Though the prison psychologist had warned her to keep her activities on death row a secret, Castillo says, she decided to speak out. Someone had to pull back the veil. I'd spent enough time with convicted men, she said, to understand the term monster reflects more on the accuser than the accused, she explains in the book. Most people, even the rule breakers, are not dangerous, immoral, or unredeemable. Everyone is broken, but for some, the brokenness is easier to hide. In May 2014, she wrote an op-ed for the News and Observer. I've been meeting twice a month with about 15 men on death row, and the experience has both been edifying and moving. I don't see heartless killers, though they might have killed in a moment of heartlessness. I see anger problems, stubbornness, lack of self-control, immaturity, and miseducation. I see those qualities in people outside the prison, too. I see them in myself sometimes, but in these men I also see pain, regret, a capacity for kindness and self-reflection, and a desire to be seen for what they are, flawed and very human. She appealed her dismissal, writing that with her journaling class gone, her students lost something that broke the relentless monotony of prison life. Her pleas came to no avail, but she didn't give up. She began writing the men. What was initially a flurry of responses turned into a steady correspondence of letters about prison, family, books, spirituality, personal growth, and coming to terms with their senses. Sometimes they were cheerful, she writes. Other times they were half mad from emasculation and grief. George Wilkerson writes, having no deep relationships deprives us of the richness of humanity has to offer. To love with all our hearts, to laugh till we cry, to grieve till we feel almost dead. Life isn't meant to be bland, comfortable, and safe, and painless. A condemned person's capacity for kindness and reflection was best exemplified by former drill sergeant Earl Richmond, Jr., who was executed in 2005 for the 1991 murders of four people while addicted to drugs and alcohol, known as E. His fellow death row prisoners later described him as a peacemaker who talked others out of fighting. He was universally respected by guards and prisoners alike. Two guards who worked on death row transferred to other prison blocks after his execution. It was too painful. The day the state killed Richmond, he refused a last meal, medication, or self-pity. My victims got no last meal, Richmond wrote in a letter he read the night before his death to his 78 fellow prisoners. Lyle May was one of them. In 2003, North Carolina put seven inmates to death, making it the deadliest year at Central Prison since the state reinstated capital punishment in 1984, after a 23-year hiatus. May began cutting his legs and arms with razors. Self-mutilation is something I dealt with since childhood, never really understanding why I did it, but turning to it in dark moments like the worst kind of drug, he writes in crimson letters. On death row, the behavior continued as a way to pierce the mind-numbing horror of executions. He stopped, he writes, when Richmond began training him in calisthenics. Exercise became an alternative to prison-prescribed drugs and self-abuse. Under Richmond's tutelage, May's self-esteem improved. He began taking classes offered by UNC Chapel Hill. In 2007, he transferred his studies to Ohio University's Independent Studies Program, where he earned an Associate of Arts degree in 2013. In 2017, he was accepted into the university's Bachelor of Specialized Studies Program. Along the way, he spoke into college classes via telephone and contributed articles to criminal justice websites and essays to Scalawag, a Southern social justice magazine. Though E. freely admitted his guilt and remorse for his crime, May writes, he used it as a catalyst for change instead of as a scourge, living the remainder of his life as we all should have been from the beginning. When Richmond's execution date was set for May 6, 2005, there was a talk of prisoners of disrupting his sentence. Richmond put a stop to the threat of violence. I know y'all love me. Richard told the prisoners, I know this hurts. It hurts me too. But love and respect me enough to keep calm. Help one another through this like we have done for other executions, because we're family, and that's what family does. Well, I'll move ahead now to some culture articles. Byron Woods writes a theatrical review of Orange Light. We read a review from their author, or an article about their author, a couple of weeks ago in Indie Week. Orange Light is through Sunday, February 16th, at the Fruit in Durham. Though the Imperial Foods fire in Hamlet was one of the worst industrial disasters in North Carolina history, the catastrophe quickly receded into the past. A casualty of our culture's unwillingness to count the human costs of an economy where cheapness supersedes most other values. That makes local playwright Howard L. Kraft's latest drama, Orange Light, an act of both remembrance and defiance. Its credo comes in an early interview sequence for a supposed documentary when orphaned character John Crutchfield, by Carly P. Jones, says, we do a lot of forgetting in this country. I tell my story for the memory. Those memories are somewhat scrambled, though, by Kraft's choice to make Orange Light a theatrical roman à clef. Some characters are easily paired with real-world counterparts. Venomous plant manager Bob Buchanan, a vivid Abbey Toot, is a clear stand-in for Brad Rowe, son of plant owner Emmett Rowe, who opened his chicken processing plant in a small, economically depressed southern town after difficulties in states with stronger unions and safety regulations. Racist former fire chief J.P. Calhoun, Elizabeth Lewis Corley, is presumably David Fuller, who repeatedly refused help during the disaster from an African-American volunteer fire department only 5 minutes away. Only Jesse Jackson retains his name in video footage and an on-stage impersonation by Lakeisha Coffey. But the five women at the heart of this drama remain more obscure. Coffey lends her trademark authenticity to Wilma Everett, a no-nonsense woman whose carpal tunnel syndrome jeopardizes her job. Under Joseph Magel's direction, Jones plays Everett's friend, Laverne, a single mother, struggling to raise two contrary boys. Actor Aurelia Belford ably brings to life the bright Quisha King, who tries to convince co-worker and songwriter Jenny Buckley, Cree Schaefer, to agitate for safer working conditions. Corley also depicts the plight of Mary Ford, an aging worker who falls prey to Buchanan's machinations to keep his workers under his thumb. There's song and dance in the country anthem Women Through It All. Versatile songwriter Reese Palmer conjures a dead-end small town where there ain't no point to prove, ain't nowhere to move. A later Love Beyond Death song, Mama Made It Happen, is more mawkish. In 60,000 pounds, Aya Shabu's choreography mechanizes the rhythmic lockstep of factory labor. The frame of Alex Maness's videos evokes Anna Deavere Smith's documentary theater works. But the fictional composite character suggests the experiences of the living and dead are more important collectively than individually. When a character speculates on a motive other than theft control for the padlocked fire exits, are we in the realm of lightly fictionalized fact or the playwright's imagination? The unlikely admissions of a defense attorney further stretch the limits of believability. The strife and strivings of workers trapped, in Jackson's words, by economic desperation and oppressive work laws ring the truest in Kraft's play, which Bulldog Ensemble Theater is currently producing at The Fruit. But it's less clear. Fictive trappings call into question the act of memory that Orange Light seems to be. And the reviewer, Brian Woods, gives it 3.5 stars. On to books. Gene Shapland, book, My Autobiography of Carson McCullers. She gleans a suppressed story of queer desire in the life of the famed Southern author. Sarah Edwards writes this. How do you tell a story that you believe someone was never able to tell? Jen Shapland answers this midway through her first book, My Autobiography of Carson McCullers, which she'll read aloud from at Flyleaf Books on February 12th. To tell another person's story, she writes, a writer must make that person some version of herself, must find a way to inhabit her. Shapland's memoir accomplishes this by weaving her own process of self-discovery with that of her subject. Her interest in the writer began in 2012 when she was interning at the Harry Ransom Center in Texas, where some of McCullers' material is archived. She'd never read any of McCullers' writing, but stumbling across a set of fiercely tender letters between the author and a woman named Anna Marie Schwarzenbach, Shapland was transfixed. In these letters, Shapland saw a queer side of the Southern author, which has always been known, but never explored in depth. She also began to work through transcripts from McCullers' therapy sessions with a woman named Mary Mercer. In McCullers' photos, letters, and transcripts, formative relationships with these two women flicker just below the surface, never fully seeing the light of day. Shapland also began to see her own experience, a childhood in a small town, struggles with chronic illness, evolving queer desire, reflected in the research. Soon, newly in her first relationship with a woman, she found herself staying at McCullers' childhood home in Columbus, Georgia, ordering takeout pizza and taking long, possibly forbidden, baths in the family tub. The resulting memoir is a fluid, fragmentary blend of archival research and personal storytelling that pays homage to the complexity of queer narratives. McCullers, a playwright and novelist of outcasts and misfits in the Deep South, was born in 1917. Upon marrying Reeves McCullers, an ex-army man and failed writer who was often given false credit for her work, at the age of 20 she moved with him to North Carolina, first to Charlotte and then to Fayetteville, where McCullers finished The Heart is a Lonely Hunter. The debut novel won instant acclaim. In the New Republic, Richard Wright wrote the book possessed astonishing humanity and a despair that was unique and individual. She was 23. As a literary persona, McCullers cut an eccentric figure. In photographs, her lounging posture is as leisurely and lugubrious as her drawl. She died at the age of 50, and during her life she experienced chronic illness, a tumultuous marriage, the suicide of her husband, and, as Shapland would have it, a sexuality she was never able to fully inhabit. She was deeply in touch with loneliness and longing, and her writing is threaded with brutal truths about reciprocity. Most of us would rather love than be loved, she wrote in The Ballad of the Sad Cafe and other stories. Almost everyone wants to be the lover. And the curt truth is that in a deep, secret way, the state of being beloved is intolerable to many. McCullough's feelings for Schwarzenbach, a tempestuous figure who, in the letters, seems more into being beloved than returning the favor, were largely unrequited. With Mercer, with whom McCullough began therapy at age 41, there appears to have been more mutual affection. In Illumination and Night Glare, McCullough's unfinished autobiography, she writes that meeting Mercer was the happiest and most rewarding experience of her life and made her awash in the joy of self-revelation. Still, Chaplin says, biographers have never made much of McCullough's relationships with women. In the posthumously published autobiography, her correspondence with Schwarzenbach was admitted entirely, despite McCullough's explicit wish that it be included. It was her retroactive closeting by peers that I found most disturbing, Chaplin writes. If Carson was not a lesbian, if none of those women were lesbians, according to history, if indeed there is hardly a lesbian history, do I exist? My autobiography of Carson McCullers draws that history to the surface, queering the texts with an experimental, sinuous style that honors the non-linearity of McCullers' own experience. Chaplin is an informal writer, but her genre-blurring search for the self is serious. At no point does she claim to be an objective or reliable narrator, as she sinks into McCullough's bathtub. She's making good on her promise to inhabit the writer. The result is raw and a little messy, like a paper cut, but that's as it should be. McCullough's writing is also raw and messy. Her characters flicker at the edges, lonely, homesick for love, unable to articulate their desires or step fully into the frame. They yearn. Their writer does, too. Let's slide on over to Michael Papich's food and drink column, New Arrivals, Cottage Industry. As Kerry begins work on its new downtown park just across the street, one of the city's oldest buildings is taking on a new life. Michael Chong's MC Modern Asian Cuisine is taking over the historic Sam Jones House at the corner of Walnut and Academy, next to the Kerry Arts Center. The restaurant is slated to open for dinner on February 11. There's not enough fine dining or unique restaurants in this area, and that's what we want to provide, says Chong, formerly the executive chef at the now-closed An Cuisines and the executive chef and owner of Elements Restaurant and Wine Bar in Chapel Hill. A modest Queen Anne-style cottage with a wraparound porch, the house was built in 1902 and acquired by the town in 2011. In 2017, the building gained historic landmark status. That year, Chong entered into a 10-year lease with the town. It had previously been occupied by the southern farm-to-table restaurant Bell, which closed in 2016 after failing to pay sales taxes. Chong says that just over 2,000 square feet, MC will be the smallest space he's ever operated. Chong's family fled communist Vietnam when he was 15, first to a Singaporean refugee camp and then several months later to New Orleans. There he studied architecture and worked in the kitchens of the Intercontinental Hotel as a side job. The culinary arts snapped into place as his sole focus, though, and he worked in hotels and restaurants around the city. In 1997, he moved to Cary and began work as an executive chef at Prestonwood Country Club, where he remained for nearly a decade before opening An in 2006. Compared to these efforts, MC Asian Cuisine is a smaller project, but he expects it to be lively. I've always wanted a restaurant in a classical, fun setting, Chong says. It's the intimacy. It's the history here. I will work as long as my health allows. Cooking is a passion. I will keep coming up with new dishes and exploring new techniques and flavors. He plans to split his time between MC and Elements, whose menu features a high-end mix of European and East Asian culinary styles. At MC, he says the smaller digs will require a more dynamic menu. The kitchen is small, so it cannot provide a lot, so that means we will have a smaller menu and we will have to change it so people don't get bored, Chong says, but that's also good for us. It's good to change up our dishes and we can use seasonal products. As for what customers can expect, Chong says it will be in line with what he's offered at Elements, Asian-style seafood and French-style vegetables. but it will also include more high-end sushi with a starting menu that features Japanese seafood and Wagyu beef. Under Chuang's direction, the Sam Jones house is getting a makeover. He's put in new wood floors, relocated the bathrooms, and restored and opened up the central fireplace. I wanted to embrace the historical, Chuang says. This included the use of traditional style Italian furniture, as well as antique artwork and Vietnamese instruments as decoration. In the dining room, antique red and black hand-painted cabinets from China are functional as well as decorative. In MC's entryway, a custom wine cabinet fills an entire wall. MC also serves as an entry point to downtown Cary, which has gotten much busier in the 4 years since the completion of the Academy Street renovation. It'll get busier still once the 7-acre, $50 million downtown park opens in 2022. The park is a great thing for the town of Cary, Chung says. The infrastructure downtown was old, so now the town is taking a different approach. I'm glad to be part of it. And just a little bit of room for one or two events. Friday, tomorrow, February 7th at 7:30 p.m. for $119. Soulful Chefs. This is a super secret event. So if you sign up, organizers will send the address of its farmhouse location. If that detail isn't enticing enough, maybe the list of local chefs will help. Phoebe Lawless, Ryan McGuire, Sophia Wu, Matthew Krentz, and Kim Hunter all have a hand in preparing the meal. There's no official website for this intimate pop-up, but you can find out more by searching the event name on Eventbrite and Facebook. Soulful Chefs. Location is to be announced, and that is in Durham. Oh, my. Now, as the Balloonatunes float their music up via hot air, your hot air reader, John Feddersen, will ready our blimp for its descent. Reading for a blind and print-impaired audience. North Carolina Reading Service, formerly Triangle Reading Radio Reading Service, now closes this edition of Indie Week. But you can find it all week in the podcast section of our website. Happy landings, folks. At least I hope I have one. And we will be back with you next week with Indie Week.